Forecast presents now the first program of a proposed new dramatic series entitled Double Feature. Double feature tonight, two plays, one from each of the twin capitals of American entertainment, Broadway and Hollywood. One a light comedy, the other a serious drama. Each acted for you by players of recognized skill and proven reputation on the screen and in the legitimate theater. From New York, Edna Best, Richard Worf, and Roy Atwill in Ever After by Keith Fowler. From Hollywood, Charles Laughton and Elsa Lanchester in To Tim at 20 by Norman Corwin. The Broadway end of our transcontinental stage takes the spotlight first with a little lighthearted research concerning an old dramatic problem, the happy ending. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy finds girl again. They live happily ever after. Well, maybe. Let's look into a specific case, one everyone knows about. It's almost 3 years now since those two star-crossed lovers, Snow White and Prince Charming, were united in cinematic wedlock by the ever-admirable Walt Disney. Did Snow White and Prince Charming live happily ever after? Well, we've commissioned a reliable reporter, Keith Fowler, to find out. And Mr. Fowler has embodied his findings in a short play called Ever After. As Snow White in Ever After, you will hear Edna Best, now on vacation in New York, after completing a dispatch from Reuters for Warner Brothers. As Prince Charming, we present Richard Worf, associated for the past several seasons with Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne, in There Shall Be No Night, The Taming of the Shrew, and Idiot's Delight. Roy Atwell plays the dwarf named Doc, as he did for Walt Disney, and Mark Smith plays Grumpy. Edna Best and Richard Worf with Roy Atwell and Mark Smith in Ever After. Scene, the royal suite in the royal palace of the royal capital of the kingdom ruled by Prince Charming. It is the morning of the third wedding anniversary of Snow White and the Prince. The Prince is seated at the royal desk, reading royal papers of state. Snow White enters. He continues to read. Snow White speaks.
Good morning, darling.
Huh?
I said, good morning, darling. How are you feeling today?
Oh, who, me?
Charming, will you please put down those papers?
Oh, hello, darling. I didn't realize that you were here.
Of course you didn't.
Now, look, darling, I simply must dispose of this work in the next hour. Why don't you go and knit a couple of rows on that thing you knit at in the evenings? Get a little ahead on it, eh?
Has it ever occurred to you, Prince Charming, to wonder what that thing I'm knitting might be?
Well, I try not to pry into your affairs, my dear, any more than I expect you to pry into mine. Now run along like a nice little princess. I'm working, darling. That darn tune, why do I keep whistling it? Why can't I forget it?
Perhaps because deep down in your subconscious, you associate it with something very dear to you.
Oh.
Remember the day I taught it to you, dear?
Yes, and I've regretted it ever since. It's driving me crazy.
No wonder. You can't whistle for peanuts. Even Dopey could whistle better than you do.
Dopey, Dopey, Dopey. All I ever hear is Dopey. Why didn't you marry Dopey?
Sometimes I think I did. Darling, do you know what day this is?
Certainly I know what day this is. I also know what time it is. I'm not so dumb.
Passing that point for the moment, doesn't it mean anything to you? This day, I mean.
Well, it means about three times as much as I can handle. Do you know that I was up at 6:30 this morning laying cornerstones while you were still in bed snoring your head off?
Charming, I do not snore.
Well, there was some kind of an upheaval going on.
It would serve you right if I packed up and left you.
Well, why don't you? Why don't you go back to those seven repulsive little dwarfs of yours?
That's what I keep asking myself. They'd be glad to see me anyway.
Ah! Answer that fanfare, will you? Must be somebody at the door.
Your Highness.
Yes, Paige?
Be it known that two have come to pay their respects to their royal highnesses. Be it known that their names are Mr. Duck and Mr. Grumpy.
Oh, it's my darling Duck and my adorable Grumpy.
Didn't I ask you to keep those peculiar creatures out of here?
I won't listen to another word. You can beat me, but you can't be rude to my friend.
Oh, all right, bring them in. But take them down to the rumpus room, will you? And Paige, lock up the silver.
Mr. Duck and Mr. Grumpy.
Oh, you angels. I've never been so happy to see anyone. How are you, Doc?
Oh, I'm swell. In fine kettle. Fine fettle.
And how are you, Grumpy?
Rotten, thanks.
And now the prince wants to tell you how pleased he is to see you.
I'm very pleased to see you.
Pleased to meet you. Spank you. Thank you, Your Highness. Thank him, Grumpy.
What for?
Where are the other boys? Where are Happy and Sleepy and Dopey and Bashful and
Sneezy,
and...
I believe.
Yes, why didn't you all come over?
We're sort of a delegation. Doc's got a speech to make. Make your speech, Doc.
Dear Quincess, Princess, we swing, we bring you beatings, greetings.
Try it again.
Dear Princess, on this dapple hay, this happy day, your sweet face your sweet grace flows.
Oh, what is it, Grumpy? He'll never get it out.
He wants to make a speech about your anniversary. Crazy idea, a lot of sentimental bunk.
Oh, you darling.
What anniversary?
At least someone remembers. Someone cares.
Don't tell me I've been fortunate enough to miss something. I thought I'd officiated at every anniversary, every inaugural, every reunion, every groundbreaking, every closing out sale in the entire kingdom. What anniversary are they talking about?
Ours, dear. Only ours.
Ours?
Anniversary, my charming prince. Our wedding anniversary. You remember? We went down that long aisle together, and you gave me that silly ring. We were married 3 years ago today. Precious.
Well, what do you think of that? It completely slipped my mind.
Naturally.
Now, wait a minute. I'd have remembered it sooner or later.
Perfectly lovely, isn't it? When my friends have to tell my husband that he's been married 3 years.
You mean he didn't know it?
He didn't even suspect it.
I always said he wasn't good enough for you.
You keep out of this, you little what?
Don't you dare say that to Grumpy.
No, why?
Don't you dare.
No, why?
Yes, Doc.
Aren't you and the Quince, the Prince, happy together? Happy together?
I'm afraid not, Doc.
Oh, this is dreadful. If you're not happy, it spoils my whole speech. And it was a speech of a peach, a peach of a, it was good.
I know, it must have been grand, Doc, but it would hardly suit the occasion now, I'm afraid.
Well, couldn't you patch it up till I get through my beach, the speech? You know, it'd be a lot greasier, easier than speeching up the spatch, the speech.
Things have gone too far for that, Doc. This is the end.
The end of what, may I ask?
Of our life together. From this hour forward, Prince Charming, I will never darken your door again.
Well, what doors are you planning to darken? What will you do? Where will you go?
To the ends of the earth.
Now, let's be sensible.
I will not be sensible.
The ends of the earth are a long way off. If we're getting on each other's nerves, you could take another room.
No, and... my mind is made up. I won't spend another night under this roof.
All right, then leave. I'll send you a dozen flunkies to help you pack. See that you turn in your crown when you clear out.
To think that it should come to this. Oh. Oh, I wish I were dead again.
Oh, poor child. Don't peep. Don't weep.
Don't stop her. She's enjoying herself.
You can come back and stay with us, Snow White. Kind of crowded, but I guess we can put up with it.
Oh, bless you, Grumpy.
Don't bless me. I ain't used to it.
I'll come with you right now, Grumpy. I love you. Love being back in our tiny house, and it'll be so much nicer for the baby.
What's that?
Do my ears receive me? My ears deceive? Huh? Did you hear what she said?
He hasn't heard anything that I've said in 3 years. I said baby, Charming. B-A-B-Y. Baby.
You know,
Snow White. You mean that you're...
Is that impossible?
That thing you were knitting. You mean that that...
Uh-huh.
Doc, Grumpy, I'm a father.
I'll have a cigar, but I won't shake hands.
Why doesn't somebody tell me these things?
I didn't suppose that you'd be interested. After all, a baby is just a baby.
Oh, but it's mine!
Ours, dear. You might enjoy it for a few weeks, but then you'd lose interest in it and just leave it lying around and never know where it was, never know it was there, till you stumbled.
Well,
over
that's
it.
Where you're wrong, darling. I've just had a grand idea.
Something to do with the affairs of state?
Something to do with us. The house in the woods would be nicer for the baby. You said so yourself. Why can't we all go there? You and I and it.
Hey, do you think our house is made of rubber?
He's tight. That's right. We'd have to creep, sleep in layers like a rake, a cape.
Grumpy and Doc, you've done so much for me already, but would you do one more thing? Would you let the prince and me live in your house if we let you all come here and live in the palace?
Well, you're asking a lot, but take it. The roof leaks anyway.
Bless you, Grumpy.
Don't bless me. I was getting darn tired of those woods anyhow.
When the baby slums comes, it can have my bread, my bed. I've got a nice mattress, it's stuffed.
But, darling, there's one thing we've forgotten. If you go away, who'll take care of the kingdom?
Oh, that's easy. I'll appoint Grumpy and Doc and the rest of the dwarfs to act for me. Grumpy can be the executioner. He'll like that. Hey, Grumpy?
I don't give a hang.
And Doc can be Speaker of the Spouse. I mean, Speaker of the House.
That's wonderful. And Sleepy can be First Lord of the Bedchamber.
And Happy can be the Court Jester.
And Sneezy can be the Court Physician.
And Bashful can wait on the ladies-in-waiting.
But Dopey... What can poor Dopey do?
That is a problem, my dear.
I have it. Dopey can be the prince. He's just the man for it.
Now, look here, my
Paige,
dear.
Paige, take a proclamation.
Okay, princess.
Be it known that the prince and princess are leaving the palace for a sojourn of indefinite length. Be it known that they have decided to live their own lives, free of the trouble attendant upon affairs of state. And be it known that this time they are absolutely determined to live happily ever after.
Lest we stand accused of a cheap cynicism, permit us to add that Snow White and Prince Charming did live happily ever after. Moreover, they had three children, two boys and a girl. The boys later became famous as Richard the Lionhearted and Huckleberry Finn. And the little girl turned out to be Shirley Temple. Now, our double feature, a regular weekly series, a few well-chosen words from the sponsor would be well-placed at this point between the two halves of our twin bill. In the present instance, however, we proceed directly from Broadway to Sunset Boulevard. Will the engineers, in their infinite wisdom, take us to Hollywood?
The turn of a switch has carried you westward from darkness into light. That's a miracle to which you've grown entirely accustomed. It would have been just as easy to switch you eastward and deeper into darkness. You're used to that, too. Used to hearing from darkened Europe. The play that comes to you from sunbright Hollywood today has to do with a man plunged in the thick of that darkness, the man-made darkness of war. The play is by Norman Corwin, a young radio playwright who has been here in Hollywood writing for the screen. The performances are by Charles Laughton and Elsa Lanchester. Mr. Laughton, distinguished film star, has just completed his RKO radio picture, They Knew What They Wanted. And now, with Miss Lanchester, presents the Corwin-written and directed play, To Tim at 20. It is the hour before dawn in the barracks of an RAF squadron on the northeast coast of England. Gunner Marshall, who is leaving at dawn on a mission from which there can be no return, is writing a letter.
Dear Tim, tomorrow I'm leaving here to do some special work. It will be gone quite some time. So I decided I would write to you before I lose track of what it was I've been wanting to tell you. First, let me wish you a very happy 20th birthday. In doing so, I'm a little matter of 15 years ahead of myself, for at this writing, unless I've counted wrong, you are 5 years and 3 weeks old. You mustn't criticize your mother for being late with the mails, because it's not her fault. I made a special point of asking her not to deliver this letter to you until you were 20. Because I wanted to talk to you man to man, and not as father to son. I didn't want your mind to be wandering off to cricket scores, the latest mystery mover, or the ice cream man, which is what usually happens when a father talks seriously to his boy. Tim, the fact of the matter is that you know more about the world at 20 than I've any way of knowing at twice your age. And you ought to be telling me things, not I you. By the time you read this yellowing page, you'll have a much better report on the longitude and latitude of civilization than anybody around here can give out today. Frankly, we fellows just don't know where we're going. You at least can see where we've been. I dare say there's nothing I can tell you about the unpleasant work at hand that will not have been told 1,000 times between the writing and the reading of this letter. The historians and poets will be at it night and day for a century, and the maps will have it all down in black and white and red and green, showing how it was before and after. But at the moment, all I know for certain is that this is a moist, warm August night under the crescent moon, and that a cricket is around here somewhere, being terribly glad he's a cricket. And that pretty soon it'll be dawn, and the cricket will stop singing. Also, I know that a tree and a star and a wind are incredibly wonderful things not to be taken lightly, and that the earth is not a bad place to walk around on. I suppose Ma has been filling you with stories about me. Well, you probably have guessed by now that she's prejudiced in my favor. However, let it be said for the record that in many ways I am a remarkable chap. The best cribbage player in the county. Not bad at reciting Shakespeare. Handle a fine game of tennis, too, for my age. And once, when I was a little faster on my feet, I reached the semifinals in the district tournament. I lost to Fred McCreary, who later went to Wimbledon. 6-4... 8-10, 8-6, 3-6, and 12-14. Ma never cared much about tennis, so she naturally wouldn't remember the scores. I must tell you more about Ma, because unless she's changed in recent years, she never talks about herself. In all probability, she hasn't told you how it was we met, because the story's at my expense, and Ma's funny that way. But it was at a fashionable West End restaurant one winter day. I'd eaten by myself and was hopping mad about it, having been stood up for a lunch date by some nitwit of a girl. When I finished eating, I picked up my hat and coat at the checkroom, and I was about to leave when I noticed that my gloves were missing. I brought this to the attention of the hat check girl.
I beg your pardon, but I don't remember any gloves, sir.
Well, I do. I distinctly remember taking them off and handing them to you.
I'm afraid you're mistaken.
Now, look here, young woman. I don't patronize this restaurant to be told I'm mistaken.
I don't expect you do. It happens you gave me no gloves.
I don't relish being contradicted.
Neither do I. Sorry, but your gloves are not here. You'll probably find them in your coat.
Are you going to check carefully, or do I have to call the manager?
You can call the manager if you like. But he's not a magician. He won't be able to produce gloves out of the air. Are you sure, sir, they're not in your coat?
They're not in my coat. Besides, to whom do you think you're talking?
I haven't the faintest idea. My name's Tewksbury.
Miss Tewksbury, I've just had about enough. Manager, come here, will you? We'll see now that it's possible to get a little cooperation or courtesy out of you.
Yes, sir. We'll see.
Oui, monsieur. Is it anything wrong,
my
monsieur?
My good man, I merely asked this girl to look for a pair of gloves which are somewhere in that check room, since they're certainly not in this coat. Not only has she refused to oblige me, but she's,
Oui, monsieur.
I beg your pardon. I'm very sorry. They've been in my inside pocket all the time. I am sorry.
Oh, mais non, it is all right. Just so long you find your gloves. Eh bien, bonjour, monsieur. I am glad everything is all right. Bonjour, monsieur.
Miss Tewksbury, may I offer my sincere apologies?
Not at all, sir.
We all make mistakes.
Only some mistakes are more stupid than others.
Oh, it's all right. Forget it.
If you're still interested in knowing to whom you're talking, the name is Marshall. Eric Marshall.
How do you do, Mr. Marshall?
How do you do? Would it be a presumption upon so brief an acquaintance to ask you to dine with me tonight?
Well, yes, I think it would somewhat, Mr. Marshall.
Oh, I am sorry.
But not enough to interfere seriously.
Well, I say you're very forgiving. What time shall I be here?
Six and time to change. Make 6:30.
Tim, I hope you men of the second half of this poor century have sense enough to develop a fuller appreciation of women. Not that your forefathers didn't love them, for they did. But our sex has done all the swaggering and made all the big decisions and pretty much taken over the running of the earth. And we haven't made out any too well, according to the tally sheets. Rather badly, in fact. Can you imagine the female of the species doing worse? Can you fancy a diplomacy of women trafficking in sons and husbands? Well, I can't, and I doubt if you can, because there must come a special understanding of the dignity of life to those who grow it in their vitals. There are several kinds of valor, Timothy. And the least is the kind that comes out of the hysteria of battle. Courage is not a stag affair, you know. While I'm on that subject, let me tell you another story about your mother. The week before you were born, I watched for signs of apprehension that had been warning of grave risks, and I was wondering whether she, perhaps, was afraid.
I will give my love a heart.
Ellen.
Yes?
You all right, dear?
Now, what makes you ask that? Is my singing so bad?
No. On the contrary, it's delightful. I just... Go on, darling.
I'm feeling very well.
Good. Not anything I can do for you, darling? Don't you want a hot water bottle or something?
No. I'm all right.
Well, if there is anything you want, I mean to say if anything bothers you...
Nothing's bothering me, darling, but I know what's bothering you.
What?
You think I'm afraid, don't you?
Don't be silly.
You think I'm afraid something might happen.
Please, Ellen.
You see? You don't even want me to say it, do you? You're a typical nervous father. You know, the kind they draw in cartoons when the door opens and the nurse sticks her head out and says... Were you expecting anybody?
That's not very funny.
No, it's a bit on the sad side, isn't it?
Sad side? What?
That fathers should be more nervous about children coming into the world than about the kind of world their children will live in once they're here.
What have you been reading lately, darling?
Newspapers.
Oh.
Listen, I'd like you to understand something. There's nothing unique about having a child. It's a simple, everyday business.
Yes, of course.
So don't sentimentalize about my being courageous. I'm no more courageous than 50 million Chinese peasant women and a lot better taken care of.
But just the same, darling, it does call for a little nerve, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. Risks in everything, if you want to look at it that way. Crossing a street calls for nerve. From the standpoint of accident figures...
I still say it takes a good deal of grit to go through what you're going through.
Oh, yes, women are brave, all right. But we're brave individually. You men tramp up and down in hordes and sing marching songs, but there's no band playing when a woman has a baby.
That's true enough.
Sometimes I think it's just too bad that all the mothers in the world don't get together and do something with the sum total of their pain... Like getting hold of their menfolk and saying, how dare you destroy our work.
Well, of course...
And the wicked thing about it is that there are so many good people in this world. The vast majority of all populations are decent, and yet things can get into a frightful mess for everybody. Stupid, isn't it?
Yes, I see what you mean, darling.
I
see what you mean, dear. It's, yes,
Well,
I will give my love a horse with a parador. I will give my love a palace wherein.
I didn't see Tim. I wasn't close enough then. But somehow now it all comes clear. It clears up when you contemplate the meaning of a word like population. Have you ever wondered, Tim, about the cold figures in the atlases, such as Europe has a population of 500 million? Have you ever thought of a total as staggering as 1,000 million parents in terms of mass, love, and tenderness, and courage, and consideration? We don't usually number such qualities among the natural resources of the earth, like coal and oil and minerals. But there they are, common as air and water. And it's the sorrow of my time that all of man's vast raw materials of love and tenderness and courage should be cornered and destroyed by half a dozen wanton wills. I only hope that one day all the plain and simple people born of all those mothers that Ma spoke about will get together and put a quick stop to the nonsense. Oh, well, it's getting just a little lighter now in the east, which means I'll have to hurry this along. Tim, there's a comfort in knowing that the morning star which glows now so serenely in the indifferent night will hang outside your window, too, on any morning you may choose to hail it. Please give it a salute for me from where you stand. Just heard the crowing of a cock. There's a speech in Hamlet somewhere, Horatio, I think, which tells of a season when the bird of dawning singeth all night long, and spirits dare not stir abroad. Then nights are wholesome. Then no planets strike, so hallowed and so gracious is the time. To a more gracious time then, Timothy. To freedom and the England under your feet. To trees, to crickets, to the love of women, to the morning star. The sun is up, and I must now go out into the light. Good luck, Tim, your father.
Thank you, Charles Lawton and Elsa Lanchester. And our thanks, too, to Edna Best, Richard Whorf, and Roy Atwell for their contribution from New York. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Double Feature, a sample broadcast in the CBS Forecast Group intended to illustrate a proposed new series. Each week, Double Feature would bring you two contrasting plays of outstanding merit, a twin bill from the twin capitals of American entertainment, fine plays acted by Broadway stars and Hollywood players of recognized skill. Most of these plays would be written especially for this program by writers chosen on the basis of past performance in radio. Others would be repeat performances of notable radio successes of the past. Still others would represent the first radio work of celebrated Broadway playwrights and Hollywood screenwriters. Next week, Forecast will present from New York, Paul Robeson in All God's Children with Eddie Green, music by Earl Robinson, composer of The Ballad for Americans. From Hollywood, Margaret Sullivan in Bethel Merriday, based on the novel by Sinclair Lewis. Listen to Forecast next week at this hour. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.